David, I think we've got a quiet moment now. It's time to start the podcast, all right? It's the Religious Studies Project. He's Chris Cotter.
He's David Robertson.
And we are still here at Biddy Milligan's. And this is Andrew Dawson on Santo Daime.
So welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project. Today I am joined by Dr. Andrew Dawson, who is Senior Lecturer in Religion at Lancaster University. So first off, Andrew, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
Dr. Dawson is the author of quite a few books, actually, it seems. There's a sort of introductory undergraduate text just entitled The Sociology of Religion with SCM Press. He's also the editor of Summoning the Spirits, Possession and Invocation in Contemporary Religion, which came out in 2011 with I.B. Torres. And then the other one, which links into what we'll be talking about today, was New Era, New Religions, Religious Transformation in Contemporary Brazil, which is with Ashgate in 2007. What we're going to be talking about today is Santo Daime, Andrew's recent book, Santo Daime, A New World Religion, has just come out with Bloomsbury. So first off, thank you for getting a copy of the book to me, which was remarkably helpful in preparing this interview. Before we get specifically talking about Santo Daime, I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you ended up researching in Brazil, how that came about.
Okay, I've always had an interest in social justice, inclusion, participation. Growing up in inner city Liverpool, being involved in a number of sort of justice related projects, and that took me to South Central America in 1988, looking at the emergence of the base community movement throughout a number of countries in Central America. So when it came to doing my doctorate, I wanted to do some research on the involvement of the church, in this case the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. In certain justice movements in South America. Originally started researching in Argentina, and then after a few months switched to Brazil, and ended up writing a book on my doctorate and subsequently a book. It was basically about the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Brazilian state during the military dictatorship. Mm. And then tracing within that the emergence of the base community movement in Brazil, but also the emergence of what I was calling a liberative pastoral discourse related to liberation theology, but much more pastorally engaged. Mm. And situating the emergence of those two movements within the church-state relationship during the military dictatorship. Carried on looking at the liberation theology, base ecclesial movements, really through the back end of the 1990s. But in the beginning of the 2000s, I was switching my research interests anyway, looking much more at religion and society in general. So moving beyond Christianity and beyond particular sort of justice-centered, justice-focused movements. And that's when I began the research into the ever-increasing sort of pluralization of the Brazilian religious landscape. So looking beyond traditional Christianity. At a whole host of new religious movements all over Brazil. That then led to the publication of New Era, New Religions. And as part of the research for that book, somebody said to me when I was in Brazil doing some research, you really must look at Santo Daime, one of the religions that consume the psychotropic substance ayahuasca. Hmm. They regard it as a sacrament. So I duly did, popped along to a community up in the mountains of Sao Paulo, spent some time with them, and then got into researching Santo Daime as part of writing the book. And then towards the back end, really, of that research project, I decided that Santo Daime in and of itself, not least because of its internationalisation, would make a very good study in terms of the contemporary dynamics of social transformation as manifest through the contemporary dynamics of religious transformation. Mm. And the very fact that Santo Daime has internationalized, so I could take the research not just from Brazil, but also into North America and then across various parts of Europe, I think attracted me as well, because it enabled me to tie in the developments of modernization taking place in Brazil and offer some comparative, relative reflections in respect of the modernised or late modern context, if you like, of North America. and Europe.
Perfect. So, obviously, if people want to get a lot about Santo Daime, they can go to your book. But I think, certainly, I didn't know very much about it until I came to the book, and it's absolutely fascinating. If you could just maybe contextualise, tell us a bit about Santo Daime, just broad brushstrokes, but also contextualising it maybe within the Brazilian religious history.
Yeah, the term Santo Daime has no literal translation, but it can be understood in reference to a phrase that's often attributed to the founder of the movement, Irenaeu Serra, who petitioned the Lord, or petitioned God to give me light, give me strength, give me love, dai mi luz, dai mi força, dai mi amor. So dai mi means give me,
okay.
In a sort of popular linguistic sense. So Santo Daime can be loosely translated as, if you like, give me holiness or make me holy. So it's a movement really based around the pursuit of spiritual purification, spiritual awakening or holiness. It emerged in the Amazon region in the 1930s through a blend of popular Catholicism, popular Afro-Brazilian mediumistic practices, and also local indigenous or mixed race practices, the sort of central element of which, in relationship to Santo Daime, is the consumption of a psychotropic substance that has been going on in the Amazon for certainly hundreds of years. Some argue thousands of years. The sort of anthropological debates rage about that. Emerges in the 1930s, stays more or less local in the Amazon till the 1970s, when a number of urban professional, young middle class students doing the ayahuasca trail, interested in power plants, psychedelics, get wind of this community up in the Amazon. Some come up and stay, some come up and visit, some come up and go back and take their spiritual religious insights with them. And so by the end of the 1980s, Santo Daime is beginning to get a foothold within certain urban professional groups that are well immersed in new age, alternative, non-mainstream spiritualities, but are looking really to adopt Santo Daime and the sacramental use of ayahuasca as the central pillar around which their communities are organised. And that begins to take on a more institutional, organisational shape as Santo Daime, as a movement, then begins formally to spread and establish communities, or churches, as they call them, around Brazil. And very early on, from the 1990s, sort of a real sign of the sort of internationalising nature of Brazil itself, globalisation and the exponential flows and networks of people, goods, ideas, concepts and beliefs. Santo Daime begins very quickly to internationalise in the 90s, whereas today, as a result, it's got communities across Europe, across North America, across South America, even in the Middle East, over in Australasia, also in South Africa as well. In the UK, there are at least three communities. In Ireland, there's a community. In the States, there are a variety of communities right across the United States. And it was really the internationalization of Santo Daime, the way in which its transition from the Amazon to the urban industrial bases of Brazil, Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, and then abroad. It was really that interested me, along with the demographic shift that took place from being a peasant, mixed race, subsistence community, surviving, just getting by in the Amazon. It became really, by the mid-1990s, the vast majority of members were members of the urban professional, the urban middle classes, university educated, relatively more wealthy, more secure, and very much involved in new age alternative practices. And that transition, that change, as it impacts upon the basic beliefs and practices of Santo Daime, is really what I was interested in charting as a means of getting at the nature of contemporary religious change relative to modernity or late modernity.
And that is something that you definitely chart very well throughout the book, which hopefully we'll get back to you later, the whole idea of particularly, I love the world-rejecting aestheticism instead of asceticism, but hopefully we'll talk about that in a little bit. Not to fetishize the ayahuasca, but you know, people are going to want to know a bit about it. So yeah, you say it's a psychotropic substance. So what exactly is that, and how is it used in ritual? Because I remember on Saturday when I'd been reading your book in the morning, and I went to choir practice, and I said to someone, "Oh yeah, I'm just reading about this religion, and they take ayahuasca," and their immediate reaction was, "How is that a religion?" So for people who might react like that, can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, ayahuasca is a substance that's taken. It's taken in a variety of forms within indigenous communities in the upper Amazonian basin. So it's the border of Brazil with Bolivia, Peru, and other countries up there. But as it sort of passes to Santo Daime and other ayahuasca religions that have established themselves in Brazil, it's produced really by taking a vine that traditionally grows in the Amazon and a leaf from a particular shrub that traditionally grows in the Amazon. I say traditionally because part and parcel of the spread of ayahuasca religions has been the transplantation of the vine and the leaf to a variety of contexts to facilitate access to the production of ayahuasca. So basically you beat the vine. You boil it down with the leaves, and through a variety of processes of boilings and reboilings, you end up with a sort of unpleasant smelling, unpleasant tasting brown liquid that has a variety of different strengths depending on the plants, depending on the production mechanism. And this is a beverage that is consumed as part of ritual practice. Depending on the length of the ritual, some rituals may be 12, 14 hours long. So you may take every hour and a half or 2 hours a particular glass full. Some rituals are 4, 5 hours long, so you take less in volume, but not necessarily less in strength. It's a variety of active agents, but the most potent active agent in the ayahuasca consumed by Santo Daime and other movements such as the vegetable, the union of the plants, a union de vegetal, which is likewise internationalized. The active agent is dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which in various parts of the world, it's legal in Brazil when consumed as part of ayahuasca, as part of a ritual practice. But in other parts of the world, DMT is classified as a class A or category one substance. Narcotic, so it's up there with heroin and cocaine. So that's created a number of issues relative to the expansion of Santo Daime. It's led to arrests, prosecutions, in some cases large fines, in other cases imprisonments, but in other cases acquittals. And more recently, in the state of Oregon, for example, Santo Daime has been legalized in terms of its consumption of ayahuasca. The Union of the Plants has received legal protection in parts of the United States as well, and in Holland as well, legally protected. And one or two other countries are intentionally turning a blind eye.
Right.
To its consumption. Yes, it has a sort of a traditional therapeutic indigenous heritage that, as I've said, definitely goes back maybe 300-400 years, possibly more. It's established, it's legal in Brazil when taken as a ritual substance, but outside of Brazil it certainly does raise the eyebrows of people who work with a more traditional, you might even say a more restricted understanding of what constitutes religion or religious belief and practice. And that again is one of the things that really sort of piqued my interest as an academic of religion with Santo Daime, is the ways in which Santo Daime and other new alternative non-mainstream spiritualities or religious worldviews, the ways in which they challenge existing understandings or definitions of what constitutes religion in exactly the same way that Buddhism did in the 1970s. Traditional definitions of religion that dominated studies of theology, divinity, anthropology and emerging religious studies were increasingly challenged because of the implicit inclusion within definitions a belief in divine beings or supernatural agents. And then scholars of Buddhism were raising the question, well, hold on, that excludes Buddhism as a religion, yeah, or certain parts of Buddhism, because they don't believe in supernatural agents or divine beings. So you had the whole debate in the 70s, emerges again in the 80s and 90s on the back of New Age religion. Yeah. So it's something that's been rumbling on for a good while, and as well as being interested then in the sort of sociological aspects of Santo Daime as a movement related to modernity, I was also interested as a scholar of religion in the ways in which the rather exotic, non-mainstream profile of Santo Daime allows us to think about what constitutes religion, religious belief, religious practice in a new way.
Mm. There are a number of ways I could go here, but I think the one I'm going to go with, you describe in the book a sort of quite complex ritual structure, both, well, not every ritual involves the daime, does it?
Virtually every ritual.
But you describe how there's a really complex sort of ritual order, sort of places to stand, there's uniforms that you wear, that you move around in terms of seniority, spiritual seniority and things like that. And in my head, how does that translate? You're taking this drug at the same time and then having to, you know, have this very orderly form of ritual. So maybe you could describe some of those rituals and the way in which order is enforced and learned, because I was very interested when I was reading the book about how people actually learn where they're supposed to stand, how they're supposed to react, when it's okay to incorporate spirits and when it's not okay and things like that. How does that get transmitted?
I think answer that in sort of two ways. The first is to say, often when people hear, oh, Santo Daime, I think one, it was either the Telegraph or the Times in 2007, had a headline, drug-fueled religion, and underneath they had a picture of a young girl actually taking a glass of daime, glass of ayahuasca. That was meant to shock, you know. Mm. When people hear about this drug-fueled, in inverted commas, religion, the more they hear about it, and they hear about the discipline, they hear about the rigors, they hear about the application and the ritual demands of Santo Daime that are in many ways quite traditional in appearance when you look at what goes on. A lot of the headline scary inverted comma scare quotes stuff actually falls by the wayside as people begin to appreciate the ways in which Santo Daime actually has a very strong moralistic core about it. I've mentioned the word discipline. Disciplina is a key term in Santo Daime. Likewise is firmness or steadfastness is perhaps a better translation. Ficar firmi, remaining steadfast, remaining firm, is a key moral or cultural ritual virtue, as I call it in the book. So you've got the consumption of a psychotropic substance that does have effects. It induces psychotropic states. It can induce vomiting in its stronger forms, or when you're not used to it, it can induce defecation as well during rituals. So it's got a range of psychophysical effects that need managing in ritual space. It's not a free-for-all. You don't get to do what you want, when you want, how you want in a ritual. Santo Daime ritual space is very, very closely regulated, strongly regulated. Men are separated from women, the old are separated from the young. Each individual is assigned a particular place relative to their status, whether it's the status in the movement, relative to their age perhaps, or their status in a local community. And you're expected, if you're standing up, to remain within that very small space. It's less than a half a yard, half a meter square. Mm-hmm. Or if it's a seated ritual, you remain in your seat, in your place. You're expected to sing the hymns. There's lots of hymns being sung, to say the prayers. You have a responsibility, Santo Daime says, that when you enter ritual space, when you consume the daime, the sacrament, you have a responsibility, not just in terms of your own inner spiritual journey that the ayahuasca is said to help, but also in terms of generating and maintaining what's called the spiritual current, the collective communal current that each individual helps generate and maintain. And it's that interface between individual self-scrutiny, individual self-management, and community collective obligation that is at the heart of the spiritual religious dynamic of Santo Daime. And so there are a variety of different rituals in which that plays out. You have a very quiet and contemplative rituals that may take anything from 4 to 6, 7 hours, in which the whole ritual, or virtually the whole ritual, is spent sat down in the dark or with lights turned down, in which the individual, after taking daime, looks inward, thinks about yourself, you think about your moral failings, you think about the motives and keys for that, you think about how that might be corrected, and basically you work upon yourself, as Santo Daime would put it. And then you have dance rituals that are much more festive, much more celebratory. They can go on anything up to 12, 14 hours. You'll spend virtually the entire ritual, except for maybe a half hour, three quarter hour break, on your feet, dancing a number of rhythms. Are danced out and sung out there. That's very festive, very celebratory. And you also have rituals of spirit possession, of mediumship, in which individuals will, in varying ways, at varying times, again relative to status or ritual function, individuals will engage with supernatural agents, supernatural forces, in a way that is typical of a variety of different ways of mediumship. Some understand it as literally being possessed, taking spirits within oneself. Others understand it as the expansion of consciousness. Yeah. Others might talk about soul flight or shamanism, going and visiting other heavenly realms. But again, and often despite appearances, mediumistic rituals themselves are oriented to works of charity, whether you're working with the spirits of individuals who for one reason or another have lost their way, in need of help, orientation, even indoctrination, doctrinação is a term used traditionally in Santo Daime, or you're working with the powerful divinities of certain Afro-Brazilian religions, or just engaging with cosmic forces, a whole range of different practices. But right throughout the whole ritual repertoire of Santo Daime, whether you're quiet and seated, whether you're being celebratory, festive and dancing, whether you're engaging in a very intense activity of spirit mediumship, the intention is always to use the ayahuasca, to use the daime in a way that does a service to oneself, to the spiritual entities one engages, but also importantly to those sharing ritual space with you.
Yeah.
So you've got that, if you like, you've got that sort of horizontal communal collective set of obligations, and that introspective set of responsibilities to oneself. And then if you like, the sort of vertical dynamics in respect of the supernatural spiritual sphere.
How did you position yourself in relation to all this? To bring in another a previous article, you had one called Positionality and Role Identity in a New Religious Context, where you talk about the provisional insider, the potential real insider, and the counterfeit insider. So, when you presumably at some point you had to get introduced to all of these things, and at one point in the book you mentioned that, like, members of these groups have to invest a significant amount of capital, both economic, etc., to be involved. So how did you get involved? How much did you get involved? And indeed, are you still in contact with various groups?
Okie doke. Well, I mean, first of all, you've got the sort of general methodological issues. How do you begin to, as a field worker, get access to communities? In Brazil, they're legal, but they still want to keep themselves in the cells because of past involvement in what they perceive as persecution, what the authorities understand as maintaining the law, and prosecution. So you've got the whole thing about how as a field worker do I get into this, and there are a variety of different methods and strategies you can use. I used the sort of classic gatekeeper model. I went straight to the top, straight to the spiritual hierarchy, said, look, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, this is where I've been in the past. I'm not a journalist, I'm not a sensationalist, I'm an academic very much interested in your community. And the community said, well, why don't you come to our spiritual headquarters, spend some time with us, understand us. And it's like lost so much field work, it's an exchange, it's a quid pro quo, yeah? It's a this for that. It's I went along. They were looking for an academic who would be understanding, empathetic, non-sensationalist, who could also communicate on their behalf to the rest of the world that, hey, this isn't a bunch of fruitcakes who are dangerous to the basic fabric of society. So it was an element of what we also call as field workers credentialising. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went, spent time in the mother community in the heart of the Amazon region, and then was able to, if you like, trade on that, both in terms of the networks I established, the contacts I made, but also the status I accrued by virtue of having spent time at the mother community. Mm. And that then opened doors all across Brazil, North America and Europe. In terms of positioning myself as a field worker, Santo Daime is a very, very varied religious movement, religious organisation. So as any field worker would tell you, any community itself is not a homogenous unit. You're always changing tack depending on the role you're undertaking or the people you're engaging and their expectations or attitudes towards you. But also Santo Daime, you could move from a very traditional community up in the Amazon region to a community that's very oriented towards Afro-Brazilian religiosity, and to another one that's very oriented towards New Age religiosity, alternative, non-mainstream stuff. Some that are very conservative, almost cult-like, you might say, using more old-fashioned terminology, and others that are much more open to what they do and what they're about. So all the time, it's when you're getting into a new context, you're having to renegotiate what you're able to do, how you're able to function as a field worker relative to the conditions of possibility provided by the particular community with which you're working. A very firm baseline really across the whole Santo Daime movement is, if you do want to participate in religious rituals because of the obligation you have to maintaining the spiritual current, you must consume ayahuasca, you must take the sacrament of Daime. And that's something I did throughout my field work with Santo Daime. As per usual on any research project, I went through the usual committee stages, the usual scrutinies, the usual protocols, that type of thing. So nothing was done beneath the table, as it were. I very much got involved in the ritual life of the communities I stayed with, as well as the communal life as well, living with individuals, speaking informally, interviewing formally, documenting in field notes, that type of thing. I also, as sort of part of my work, but a different aspect of my work with Santo Daime, I've acted as an advocate on the behalf of a number of individuals or communities who have been arrested and prosecuted because of their religious beliefs and their ritual use of ayahuasca. So I've written a number of expert witness statements that have gone to the Director of Public Prosecutions in the UK. And at the moment, there's a case ongoing in Ireland as well. So I've done some advocacy stuff. I've also attended a number of events as a sort of an academic associate of groups, of which Santo Daime has been involved, non-mainstream alternative groups, looking for some greater form of legal inclusion, legal representation, that type of thing. Am I still in touch with members and practitioners of Santo Daime? Yes, I am, for a variety of reasons. I don't engage in ritual practice. My field work is finished. I'm not a member of Santo Daime, never have been. I'm not someone who uses psychotropic substances of this nature, either ritually or recreationally. In that sense, I do use the psychotropic agent of alcohol. I like a glass of wine or a beer. I might even have the occasional cigar, pipe, or a cigarette of tobacco. So they're the sort of psychotropic agents I indulge in the tobacco very rarely indeed. But to be honest, in terms of sort of ongoing connections with Santo Daime, I don't really know how the book is going to be received. Mm. You know, as I say, I'm an academic, not a journalist. I've sought to engage Santo Daime as much as I can relative to what I call critical empathy in religious studies, sort of traditionally known as an agnostic methodology. Yeah. In sociology of religion, following Peter Berger, some people talk of atheistic methodology. You know, I'm not about saying whether Santo Daime is good or bad, right or wrong. So I'm not engaged in those types of judgments, but I am engaged in an academic analysis of Santo Daime for people outside of the movement to understand what's going on and understand what's going on relative to broader changes in modernity. How that gets read and experienced by members of the movement, we'll have to wait and see, because the book is only just out, you know. And whereas it does draw on some chapters and some articles I've written in the past and members of Santo Daime have read and actually, you know, played a part in producing in part, the book itself really does make a sort of a big step forward in analytical observation and critical reflection. So it really does carve sort of, for me, new analytical and critical territory that I really don't know the response to that yet of members within the Santo Daime movement. Some will like it, some will be very neutral to it, some won't like it at all. Mm. That's my sort of rough guess.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, certainly from my reading of it, you've done a very good job of treading that fine line. Time is getting on, so I do want us to get to the sort of entangled late modern quality of Santo Daime. So just sort of finally, if you could tell us a bit about how it fits into our late modern context, how is it in some way emblematic of a particular late modern form of religion?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, looking at a lot of the literature that's written on Santo Daime, most of it's in Portuguese, but a growing number of publications are appearing in English. There's a lot of concentration on the use of ayahuasca, on the indigenous or mixed race Amazonian origins of Santo Daime, and not a very much that's said about Santo Daime as a modern or modernising or late modern movement. And that's what I really wanted to concentrate on. And there were two aspects of that I wanted to explore. One was the ways in which Santo Daime, as an alternative, non-mainstream religious worldview, is symptomatic, or I think you said, did you say emblematic or exemplary of certain dynamics and processes that are prevalent by virtue of key dynamics of modernization, whether it's pluralization, whether it's a state secularization or detraditionalization, whether it's resacralization, whether it's pluralization, individualization. So taking these sort of classic dynamics and processes of modernity and saying, okay, in what way does Santo Daime enable us to understand the processes of modernization as they play out within the religious landscape? So that was something I was very, very much interested in. And because members of Santo Daime are predominantly now urban middle class, spread across the large cities of Brazil and North America and Europe, that very much allows me to engage that particular approach. Another angle I was very much interested in is thinking about the ways in which modernity plays out across the world and the similarities and differences as you move from one typically modern context to the next. Brazil is modernising, North America is modern, Europe is modern, stroke modernising, depending on where you are. And thinking about the ways in which Santo Daime enables us to think about modernity or late modernity as it plays out in our globalised, commoditised, hyper-individualised social contexts. And so looking at that and trying then to trace some key dynamics or elements that I think, again, cross over from one context to the next. They are typically modern, whether you're talking about modern Brazil, modern United States or modern Europe in that sense. So there are commonalities I'm very much interested in tracking there. And that's part and parcel of a broader research project I've got, which is trying to understand modernity as a key concept that might play out with variations across the modernising world, but does play out with certain common dynamics and common features. in that sense. So that's what I was trying to do it towards the sort of back end of the book, not least in chapter five.
Yeah. There's so much, like, I could have asked about so many things, connections with esotericism, millenarianism, the sort of pathologization that Sandodame suffers, even your subtitle there, the A New World Religion, and there's a lot we could have unpacked just with that. But I want to give you the final word, in a sense, because we have just had to sweep through this in half an hour, and there's so much more we could say. If there's anything that you feel I should have asked about that you haven't got to say, just before we close.
No, I think your questions are typical in the sense of arising from the text and do justice to the text. I mean, in responding, what I've tried to do is weave into my own concerns, weave my own concerns into my responses. For example, you know, yes, Sandodame may appear to be crazy, drug-fueled, blah, 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 but when you actually look at it in the critical, empathetic, academic way, what you've got is a bona fide a religious movement, and whether you agree with the taking of psychotropics or not, it academically it's a religion or a religious worldview, a religious repertoire in that sense. It's highly diverse, it's diversifying. If it's not already in a country near you, it will be soon because of the sort of growing sort of global flows and networks involved. And basically what I wanted to do is do justice to Sandodame as a religious movement, but also do justice to my agenda, which is about understanding the ways in which understanding, interpreting and analysing religious belief and practice gives us access and insight into understanding modernity and the ways in which modernity or late or hyper modernity shapes us, moulds us as human beings, whether it's shaping us and moulding us in respect of our everyday relationships, our everyday attitudes, our everyday practices in respect of leisure, consumption and employment, or in my case shapes us particularly in respect of our spiritual quest, our supernatural orientations, our religious worldviews.
And that's a very cogent summation of the whole importance of religious studies in general. So hopefully our listeners will have been tempted to go out and find your book, which is Sandodame, A New World Religion, by Andrew Dawson, published by Bloomsbury very recently. And just thank you very much for that. And go out and get that book.
Thanks, Chris.
I think you'll agree that was a fantastic start to our new series on religion, migration and diaspora. I like Andrew Dawson's work a great deal, so it's great to hear him in person. And I tell you what, I'm also looking forward to the response this coming Wednesday from our friend, Roundtable regular, Kevin Whiteside.
Although I think this is the first time we can refer to him as Kevin Whiteside of the University of California at Santa Barbara.
That's very true. In his new alma mater,
his new milieu.
He finds himself in a different milieu.
We're delighted. Although at the time of recording, we have not seen this yet, we know that it's going to be absolutely fantastic.
I have no doubt whatsoever.
Kevin is just awesome. Some bits of news for you, folks. When this airs this week, at the end of this week, it's the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion annual conference, or annual meeting, as they call it. And we've got some of our RSP correspondents there. The Chattanooga boys, Dr. Chris Silver, and Thomas J. Coleman III will be there. You should have heard their fantastic Psychology of Religion panel a couple of weeks ago. So they'll be there. There's a number of interviews happening. We've got so many interviews happening at the moment that we're finding it quite difficult to keep track. But there's a lot happening there. And Dusty Hosley is also going to be at the SSSR, acting as an RSP representative. As far as we know, Chris and Tommy's sort of
mentor, Ralph Hood, is organising the SSSR next year. So we've been party to some interesting chat about potential RSP sort of integration into that conference, like we were with the EASR
indeed,
this year.
Yeah. But over in the States, is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that'll be amazing. Yeah.
It's in Indianapolis, I think, next year. But you know, strike that if I've got it wrong. We've had some other developments. In the paranormal world.
Yes, we've had some unusual manifestations. We've hinted at secret projects that we couldn't mention a few times recently. Now I can mention one of them. One of them was that our pal Jack Hunter, who's the editor of the excellent Paranthropology Journal, was at an invitation-only conference at the Esalen Institute, organised by Jeff Kripal, at the on the subject of the paranormal and religion. And I got in touch with him and said, "Hey, Jack, how about an interview or something? That'd be great. It'd be a nice way to cross-promote." And what we ended up with is we've got an hour of material of interviews and shorter pieces on the question of the relationship between religious studies and the paranormal. And we're still playing around with how we can put those together, but we're going to have at least two episodes on the subject coming up. So that's going to be a great week. Very exciting. And Taves was there. Jeff Kripal, many, many others. It looks really good.
Wonderful.
So thanks to Jack for that, and something to look forward to. Something else to look forward to
Is next week. It's a podcast with Mitra Barua on immigrant Buddhism in the West. And let me just check our list. This was another one recorded by Chris Silver. I didn't know if it was Chris Silver or Tommy Coleman. They're such a team. It's
the same creature, but with two heads, really.
Yeah. A great team that we've got over there, so we're looking forward to that. And our now Edinburgh pal Chris Duncan is responding to that. He's been a brilliant addition to the RS community here in Edinburgh, so we'll see now the fruits of his first few weeks in the Masters program here. Maybe there'll be some references to Steve Sutcliffe, or
maybe a Jim Cox in there. Yeah. I'm sure it will be. His methodology will be absolutely solid,
absolutely spot on, as always, of course. BASR are great. You can follow us on iTunes, on Facebook, on Google+,
on Twitter,
and of course by subscribing to the website through RSS or by email. Do use our Amazon link. It's a great thing. It helps us out, supports us at no extra cost to you.
So if you use Amazon at all, just hit on our website, click the button that says Amazon. It'll tell you all you need to know. It's really simple, really simple.
And I think from Biddy Mulligan's, it's time just to say thanks for
listening.